U.S. Treasury Secretary visits Brazil.
That's as emerging markets become the story of the global economic recovery.
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From American Public Media, hello, I'm Steve Chiotakis in Los Angeles.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York. It's the Midday Update from Marketplace.org for Monday, February 7th. Coming up, if the Huffington Post is the future of the Internet and AOL is the past, why are they getting together? Also, the business side of not enough space. And Christina Aguilera belts out a bomb at last night's Super Bowl.
And we'll hear it coming up. But first, U.S. Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner is in Sao Paulo, Brazil today. That's just a month after Brazil's new president was sworn in and just a couple of months before President Obama makes it down there. Geithner's likely to use the trip to convince Brazil to work with the U.S. to pressure China on trade policy. The BBC's Paulo Cabral is in Sao Paulo outside of where Geithner is speaking today. Good morning, Paulo.
Good morning.
What can the U.S. get out of this trip?
The intention of the United States here is to try to get close to Brazil. And over the last couple of years, these two countries have been bickering over their economic policies. Brazil complains that the weak U.S. dollar has been hurting Brazilian exports. But also the Americans complain that the restrictive measures that Brazil has put in place should not also have been used. And so there is an opportunity since the beginning of this year has a new government. There are now hopes that these two traditional partners, Brazil and United States, could get closer again.
And with the president, of course, Obama coming down there in just a couple of months, what are they going to talk about? What do the U.S. and Brazil economically have in common?
The two countries understand, say the governments, is that these countries from the Americas should get together to face the competition coming from Asia and particularly from China. You know, Brazil and other developing countries are now taking a much bigger role also in this political and economical sense. It seems certain that both Brazil and United States are concerned with cheap Chinese goods taking over markets here and in the U.S.
All right, the BBC's Paulo Cabral joining us from Sao Paulo this morning. Paulo, thank you.
Thank you.
More analysis now from Julia Coronado. She's chief economist with the investment bank BNP Paribas, and she's with us here in New York. Good morning.
Good morning.
So Treasury Secretary Geithner is there in Brazil today. President Obama heads there next month. Why is the Brazilian economy so important to the United States?
Well, this recovery globally has been all about the emerging markets. More than three-quarters of all global growth last year came from countries like Brazil and India and China. And so they are of increasing importance, and we do need to take them seriously. And our policies ultimately are very interconnected.
And Brazil, I saw, is the second largest economy now in the Western Hemisphere. I'm sure there are a million things that the Secretary of Treasury could be talking about down there, though. Why is he talking about the Chinese currency?
Well, that's one area where the emerging markets still have yet to transition into the global leaders. China in particular wants to maintain a low-valued currency and
right.
its position as a competitive exporter rather than letting its currency rise. And this hurts Brazil because Brazil does let its currency be market-based. And so if China's undervalued, by definition, Brazil is overvalued, and therefore they're exporting less and growing less than they could otherwise. The other problem that is generated by these policies is global inflation. We are seeing food and energy prices rise sharply around the globe. It's been causing political instability, and from the U.S. perspective, it hurts U.S. consumers at a still fragile point in the recovery.
Julia Coronado, chief economist at the investment bank BNP Paribas, thanks so much for your time.
My pleasure.
Well, it's not the biggest deal in the world, but it certainly is getting some attention this morning. AOL, America Online, whom you probably remember from dial-up internet days, is buying the Huffington Post, the online news and opinion site, for $315 million. Marketplace's David Gura is with us from Washington with that story. Good morning, David.
Hey, Steve.
Why this deal now? Why is Huffington Post selling to AOL?
Well, it's not like this was unexpected. The site has wanted to grow. It's entertained suitors, considered going public. But it sounds like this time the price was right, $315 million, mostly in cash. AOL CEO just spoke to reporters, and he called the deal a score for AOL. The Huffington Post may have a lot of buzz, but AOL, even though it may bring to mind days of dial-up modems and the phrase, you've got mail, still has many more visitors month after month, and Kara Swisher is an executive editor of All Things D, the The site broke the story last night. She says this could be a good way for AOL to get more revenue.
So it's just a question if they can take this, you know, interesting, really interesting, unique site on the Internet and really get advertising behind it. And that's something AOL has been suffering from, is having enough premium content to offer to advertisers.
So, David, what will this new website look like?
Well, maybe the more interesting thing is what will happen to the Huffington Post's co-founder, Arianna Huffington. I talked to Claire Enders, a media analyst in London, and she says, look, AOL's getting a good website, but what they're really paying for is the person at the top.
For Huffington Post, it looks like there is no downside except possibly getting less of Arianna Huffington's attention.
And that's because she's going to oversee all of AOL's content, not just the news, but sites like MapQuest and MoviePhone.
Marketplace's David Gura in Washington. David, thank you.
Thanks, Steve.
Well, let's get reaction now from Henry Blodgett. He's the CEO of Business Insider, and he joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning.
So let's start with the Huffington Post. Henry, what's in it for the Huffington Post to be taken over by AOL?
I think for Huffington, it's $300 million in cash, which isn't probably looking too bad given that the site was founded about 5 to 6 years ago, and also just a much bigger platform. You can say what you like about AOL, but it has a huge group of readers and users and a big subscription business. And for Arianna Huffington, it's obviously a very big platform, and she'll now be head of the whole content business.
And why does AOL want Huffington Post?
For AOL, this is a Hail Mary pass. If the company does nothing, it will go out of business slowly. And right now it is accruing a very big pile of cash because it's still profitable, has to figure out a business in the next couple of years or it really is going to die. So basically it's Tim Armstrong, the CEO, saying, let's make a big, bold move, get a good new brand, and make a full bet on that.
All right. Now, obviously, Huffington Post is a very popular website, but it's also a politically liberal website. How does that figure into the calculation for AOL?
That's going to be very interesting to see how they handle that. AOL right now is politically neutral. So given that Huffington Post is left-leaning, I would not be surprised to see them try to complement that with something on the right side, because there's no reason for them to take a political position as a media company. It's possible that they now want to be a left-leaning media company. I don't know, but that is an unusual and big question that'll be going forward.
Henry Blodgett, CEO of Business Insider, thanks so much for your time this morning.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Monday, the 7th day of February. I'm Steve Chiotakis in Los Angeles. You can follow me on Twitter at Radio Chio.
I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York on Twitter at Jeremy Hobson. Easy to remember, isn't it, Steve?
It is. Okay. Your name.
And don't forget, you can also get the latest look at the markets by checking out the numbers section at marketplace.org. Now let's get to the global perspective. What's happening in business and economics at the intersection of the U.S. and the rest of the world? Banks have reopened in Egypt, but the stock market will remain closed for at least another week. Remember, all the turmoil we're seeing in the Middle East started in Tunisia. And now the new transitional government in that country is working to deal with the serious economic problems that sparked the revolution. Sabri Benachour reports now from the capital, Tunis.
Go to a cafe and speak with just about any young person in Tunisia these days, and you're bound to hear similar stories. Here's 24-year-old Wafat Limen.
I have a degree in marketing and I'm working in a call center. Some of my colleagues have master's degrees. We even have a guy with a PhD there.
And if they're from the interior of the country, you'll hear how things are even worse there. Kauthar Jabali is 29.
We have 5 people with master's degrees in my family, and none have been able to get a job in 5 or 6 years.
It's estimated that 30% of young graduates are unemployed. Tunisia has invested in education more than almost any other country in the region. But in recent years, some economists say the education system has been paying more attention to churning out grads than to making sure they're prepared for the real world. At the same time, the former government neglected economic development in huge swaths of the country. The result? A lot of educated people without jobs, especially in poorer areas.
That's the major problem that we need to face. Everything leads to that, and everything comes from that.
Elias Jouini is in charge of social and economic reform for Tunisia's transitional government. He says it wants to decentralize decision-making and focus economic development on poorer areas.
Right now, everything is decided in Tunis as far as investment goes. and that hasn't necessarily corresponded to actual needs.
The new government has already given out cash to unemployed graduates to help make ends meet. It's also looking to boost private sector job creation, possibly through simplifying regulations and providing lines of credit. In Tunis, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
To Britain now. Forget any resentment for people with gobs of money in the financial downturn. To get more investors in that country, the UK could make it easier for the super rich to get a British passport. From London, reporter Christopher Worth has more.
Since he became prime minister last year, David Cameron and his government have drafted tough new immigration rules. Cameron's government is introducing a cap on the number of people from outside the European Union who can settle in the UK. But those rules won't apply to the wealthy. Sarah Molly is with Britain's Institute for Public Policy Research.
I think they will be fighting quite hard to counter the impression that migrants are not welcome. But I think, yes, their intention will be to try and attract wealthy Americans and others from outside the EU to invest in the UK.
Under the proposal, investors bringing in over $16 million will be directed into the immigration fast lane and could become permanent residents of the UK within 2 years. Give me your poor, your tired, your huddled masses. Just give me your rich. In London, I'm Christopher Worth for Marketplace.
Tablet computers and e-readers do a lot of things. But Steve, in Japan, they're now being used to clear space.
Yeah.
Japan is the world's biggest market for paper books. And it's also home to some of the world's tiniest apartments.
Oh, yes.
According to Bloomberg now, dozens of companies there are racing to convert paper books into e-books because, of course, people want to read, but also so they'll have a little extra room in a country where the average living space per person is 398 square feet. You're listening to the Midday Update for Monday, February 7th in New York. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And in Los Angeles, I'm Steve Chiotakis. Check out our website for the latest numbers, updated podcasts, and you can share your thoughts there, too, at our website, marketplace.org.
Well, financial regulators are expected to unveil tough new rules on clawbacks and holdbacks today. Don't know what those are? Well, let's just say the new rules will keep top traders and executives in check when it comes to risky deals. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman explains.
The new rules from the Fed and FDIC will require holdbacks, that's paying out bonuses over several years instead of all at once, and clawbacks, which let a firm reclaim bonus money if a risky deal by an executive or trader goes bad. Charles Elson directs the University of Delaware's Center for Corporate Governance.
Delaying the payment of a bonus and using a restricted stock in place of cash is really the ideal way to align the interest of the employee with the long-term interest of the shareholders of the company. I think discourage people from taking the kinds of risks that ultimately get companies in trouble.
Christopher Whalen at Institutional Risk Analytics says caps and clawbacks are likely to get even tougher.
So you're going to see this going on for years. It's going to get very ugly for people who work in finance.
Wall Street bonuses are actually down slightly this year, according to Bloomberg, but a 10-year veteran oil or bond trader will still take home $1 million in compensation. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Jeremy, we say happy belated birthday to President Reagan. If he were
Indeed.
Still alive, yes, he would have turned 100 years old over the weekend. So that got us thinking, what would our 40th president have said about the economy of 2011? We really can't answer that question, but we can look at the economic decisions he made to give us clues as to how he'd have reacted to today's fiscal issues. Fortune Magazine's Alan Sloan remembers the Reagan years, and he's with us now to talk about his economic legacy. Good morning, Alan.
Good morning, Steve.
So conservatives hold the late President Reagan as sort of the standard bearer, right, for their economic philosophy. Lower taxes, smaller government spending, yet budget deficits ballooned year after year during the Reagan presidency. How did those deficits sort of affect the budgets that are being passed these days?
Well, what they did was they made it permissible to have budget deficits that used to be unthinkable. And because the world did not end when the government ran enormous budget deficits, everyone figured in Washington, well, let's just keep on doing it.
Now, Reagan is given credit for cutting taxes, but he actually worked very closely, and I can remember this, with then-Speaker Tip O'Neill on budgets and on fixes for the Social Security program. Why do our current slate of politicians have such difficulties getting together on these big issues?
Reagan and O'Neill were on the same planet. Reagan agreed to increase taxes, and O'Neill agreed to cut benefits and raise taxes on Social Security. After 30 years of everyone demonizing their opponents, the Tea Party people and the Democrats, they're not on the same planet. They may not even be in the same universe, and it's very hard to talk when you're dealing with an alien.
Some conservatives believe Reagan's economic philosophy laid the groundwork for expansion that took place in the 90s. Do you agree with that?
No. But of course they agree with that, because you cut taxes, there was prosperity, ergo A created B. You could make a similar argument that Clinton raised taxes and there was prosperity in the 90s. The thing that really happened, I think, that neither party did, was there was this enormous stock boom. It increased tax revenues. It let all sorts of employers not have to fund pension plans. And that was much more a factor in the 90s boom than I think Reagan's tax cuts were in the 80s.
Fortune Magazine's Alan Sloan. Alan, thanks.
You're welcome, Steve.
Well, if you saw some or all of the Super Bowl last night, and I'm guessing you did, you might have seen that cute Volkswagen commercial with the Darth Vader kid. Have you seen that, Steve?
I saw it. It was very cute.
It's very cute. In fact, you and I didn't have to wait for the Super Bowl to see the ad because it was up on the web last
week.
Yes,
it was.
And in fact, many companies are deliberately doing that. They're taking part in the latest trend in advertising, the preview. Marketplace's Jennifer Collins reports.
Procter & Gamble launches new Old Spice commercials on TV today, but the company has been teasing the ads, featuring spokesman Isaiah Mustafa, for weeks online.
Hello, ladies.
A preview may seem a bit presumptuous for something like 30 seconds of airtime. George Belch teaches marketing at San Diego State University.
Probably a lot of consumers are probably trying to find ways to avoid ads rather than to pay attention to them.
Belch says for commercials that already have a following, like the Old Spice campaign, like some of yesterday's Super Bowl ads, teasers allow companies to build audience on their websites, on Facebook, or on Twitter. Tim Calkins is a marketing professor at the Kellogg School of Management.
All of a sudden, the return on investment begins to improve because you're getting now a lot more for your money.
He says ad previews are just getting started. I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
And finally, concerning the Super Bowl, Jeremy, you probably heard about Christina Aguilera's performance of the Star-Spangled Banner.
Yeah, didn't get it quite right.
She didn't remember all the words, so she made some of them up.
What so proudly we watched at the twilight's last reaming.
Did you hear it, Jeremy? She sang Twilight's Last Reaming.
I've never heard that version before.
Oh, because it's not a line in the national anthem, and to my knowledge, not a line in any song that we know of. Despite the flub, though, Aguilera did tell the Associated Press, quote, "I can only hope that everyone could feel my love for this country and that the true spirit of its anthem still came through."
Yeah, you know, I'd say give her a break. She get in front of that many people
That's
in live
right.
TV. It must be
spirit noted, Christina. Spirit noted. I'm Steve Chiotakis in Los Angeles,
and I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
"What is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?"
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.